Everybody, welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Lee Camacho Rooks, author of the short story collection Moon Trees and Other Orphans, published by Black Lawrence Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Lee is here to chat with us today and give us a reading from her book titled Moon, Trees, and Other Orphans.
For those not familiar with Lee, she is a Cuban-American author who lives and works in Central Florida. Currently, she's an assistant professor of English and Humanities at Beacon College. For her creative work, she has been the recipient of the St. Lawrence Book Award, the Glenna Lucie Prairie Schooner Award, and the Robert Watson Literary Review Prize. Her fiction, poems, and essays have appeared in a number of journals, including Kenyon Review, Prairie Schooner, Rhino, Tri-Quarterly, and others. As Pam Houston says of her work, the women in Lee Camacho Rook's stories carry guns, and they know how to use them. This is the best kind of fiction, well-honed, lean, and flinty, with deep pockets of compassion and vulnerability. Moon Trees is a truly stunning literary debut. We're so delighted to have Lee here with us today and looking forward to her reading from this collection. How are you feeling today, Lee?
Doing really good. Got myself a little drinky poo here. I'm ready to talk to you guys.
We're totally looking forward to talking with you about your process and excited you'll be reading a 10 to 15 minute excerpt for us today. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I love it. I get terribly nervous, but I really, really love it. I write out loud, so I think that there's something in like the language that I just love to speak and hear.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to know how this short story collection fits into your trajectory. Can you talk about how it connects to your other writing or what you're doing?
Yeah, so this collection got put together, well, didn't really get put together, but it started when I was getting my MFA, and part of it was my MFA thesis. And then, you know, it was just a matter of continuing to work on it and continuing to work on it while I was doing other projects. I have what they call a novel in a drawer, which is to say a novel that's sort of written, but not out in the world. And it takes two of the characters from this collection and follows them sort of right after their stories start.
How do you go ahead and take a shorter piece and make it into a larger work?
It's really interesting to wonder what happens after a short story. Short stories' endings are not necessarily neat. And right. For me, the interest in a short story is to figure out the kinds of short stories I write is to follow a course of change in the character, something dramatic that makes mm-hmm. them step over some sort of line and figure out why that happens. And then for me, that's the end of the story, basically. A novel is a very different thing. It was described to me as, by Hilma Wolitzer, novels were described to me as not longer than short stories, but wider. Mm. There's a lot of slash room to play around, and there's a lot of sideways courses. There's a lot more discovery. And so it was interesting writing something like that with these characters. And then I'm working on a new novel, but I also am writing flash fiction these days that is not in a similar universe. It's often magical realisms or science fiction. So I've got a lot of projects under construction.
It sounds like you do a lot of different genres like I enjoy doing as well. And when you were putting this book in particular together, though, how did you pick? Were there stories that were chosen and then rejected? How did you select? And what was your process putting together the exact collection that we received when we went to the bookstore and bought this?
Some of these stories were not originally in the book as I conceived it. Others I took out and put back in and took out. And there's a few stories that just I kept trying to put in but never worked. Ultimately, I had a question. What's the difference between just a stack of short stories and a book of short stories? Like what makes it a book as opposed to just a collection or just a random collection of short stories? And that was a hard question. And I went around and around and around. How do you decide how to order a collection, et cetera? But it always came back to what does that mean to make a book? A lot of advice out there in ordering collections is stuff like put your best story first and put your best story last. Oh, and then put your best story in the middle. And I'm like,
put your story that came out in the most famous venue first.
Yes,
right? Exactly.
And all of this is lovely. But first of all, I couldn't tell which were my best stories, right? I love them for different reasons. I'm the one who wrote them. I'm the one who spent a bunch of time on them. Of course I love them. That's my job. It's critics' jobs to have the other opinions.
Yeah, you know.
And then, right. And then none of that made sense to me. I couldn't wrap my head around it. My brain doesn't work that way. So I asked myself, what do I know about books? And one of the things I know about books is the first pages in a book teach you how to read the book.
Yeah. Okay.
So then it was a matter of finding a story that said something about the rest of the book. And then anything that didn't fit with what it was saying sort of went out, and things that I felt, oh, this dude does fit with what I'm trying to say here. And so for me, ultimately, it became a thematic voice that drove the decisions in the book.
I know I've had a number of short story collections that have come out, and they've all felt a little bit like a different baby to me, like a different animal, you know, like one of them I wrote all sequentially into its own collection. And that just was a linked voice, full movement collection through a certain series of themes that were written all in a very condensed period of time. And then I've had other collections that have had like 20 years of stories that have suddenly just been ordered and put into placements on the basis of some other factor. Do you feel like you might have differences in the way that you compile different manuscripts as you move forward?
Absolutely. I'm working on a manuscript of flash fiction right now, sort of in the background. And that all has a very specific timeline. It's all interconnected. It's a post-apocalyptic, post-alien invasion set of flash fiction. I published.
I'm sorry, it's my weird showing because, you know.
I know, right? I've been lucky enough. Jellyfish Review published one of the pieces, and Moon City Review, has published another one. And so at first I was like, nobody will even want to read this. And I'm like, yeah, I'm actually pretty excited about it. And it has sort of almost a novel structure, even though all of the pieces are independent, fully independent. And so that one, I know exactly how I'm writing it. I know what it wants to be as a full collection or chapbook. I'm not really sure how long I can sustain it. So I think that what you do, depends on the project that you're tackling and what it is.
Stories tell you what they're going to be sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
And one thing that I really feel is true about flash fiction in particular is you got to go, how is the reader reading this? How are they absorbing this particular thing? How are you ordering it to make it available for the reader in little glimpses? And or how does it read when you read it in a combinatory way?
Yeah. And that's an interesting problem with this project. It's how much do I repeat, right? Mm-hmm. This is a project of a historical event told at different points after the event from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so how much do you repeat? How much is unimportant if people know it for an individual story kind of thing? And so it's strange because it's like I'm writing two different kinds of books. I'm writing sort of a novel told from multiple perspectives, but I'm also writing a collection because these all have to stand in my mind independently. And so there's just imagining the different kinds of readers for that flash has been a challenge, and it's a fun puzzle. I think it's why I keep coming back to it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about your stories is the language in them. It's really taut and lean and edgy and still so really descriptive. I wanted you to talk a little bit about your revision process. How do you get there?
I'm a person who breaks all of the rules that you will see writers sharing on Twitter. I've always felt like I'm a failure in terms of what is a writer supposed to do. Everyone says, get it all on the page, just write forward, don't think about it, don't try to be perfect, write forward. And my brain won't let me do that. And so I'm super recursive on first drafts. I write a sentence, I go back, I read the paragraph, I tinker with the sentence, I go forward. I think part of it's because I started in poetry where the line was so important. And so even if I know that those sentences will be revised, I can't conceive of the next line until it at least sounds mostly right. And so I'm very labored first drafter.
Now, and then, are you doing that with the novels as much with flash and short? Because I can do it with short stories, but with novel, I'm just sort of plowing through. It's different.
I can't plow through. I'm trying to learn how to plow through. I'm terrible at it. My brain won't let me. So then for revising, it's sort of, it's looking for things like resonance images. If there's an image in the story and it's really doing some hard work, how can I make that reverberate throughout the story? If there's an image in the story that's not working, do I need to get rid of it? Is there a better image or can I tighten it? The same thing goes for language. How is the language now not just playing on its own, but with the larger tone of the story? Then it's like having something like a piece of clay that's vaguely the shape of a vase that I can really kind of go in and etch and take away anything that's not supposed to be there and push in new pieces of clay that need to be there. And I love it. I love revision. Revision is just fun. It's play for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Sometimes it feels like, to me, you do a rough draft, right? And that's kind of like a fictive dream that's going on in your head. And then it feels like the second edit is kind of an embroidery edit where you populate details for the reader that maybe were in your head but didn't make it to the page.
Yeah.
You know? And then maybe the third edit is the language tightening edit where you're like looking at the various sentences and the rhythms of the prose as you're moving through it. Do you feel like that's just kind of all happening simultaneously for you during your edits then?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Language and the way it sounds is often a thing to me. So if it doesn't work in my ear, it doesn't work for me. So that is maybe my primary starting place, but that's not enough to create a story. That's lovely. And that's a nice obsession to have. That's right. Not enough to create a story. I know my weaknesses. People often talk about the strength of my writing in terms of place, but that started as an amazing weakness for me. I really neglected it early on in my career. And so now I'm sort of very vigilant about.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that because I think you do an amazing job of pulling place into your writing and writing about a place like Louisiana, especially Cajun country in the bayou can be kind of tricky, can sometimes fall into cliche, but you really do it in an authentic way that situates the reader strongly in that place. So how did you get to where you are now that you have honed that skill so well?
So when I started writing many, 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 many eons ago, I came from, you know, high school where you learned that setting was place and time. And that was not terribly interesting to me. You know, 5 o'clock at a school, like I didn't understand its purpose. And so it took me a long time and a lot of study and a lot of great mentors to help explain the purpose of setting and help me understand why it's so important and reading.
Please do name drop these mentors here. I love hearing who people are impacted by.
This is everyone from Craig Leslie, who I studied under at Pacific University, and Kwame Dawes and Ellen Bass and Bonnie Jo Campbell and Ben Percy. And then also back to when I was reading, I was revisiting people I'd studied under at Southeastern Louisiana University and Tim Gautreau, who's reading one of Tim's books, The Missing. Mm-hmm. And it was like my mentors had been talking to me about this. I'd been studying, I'd been reading place philosophers. I'd been doing all of this sort of deep work to understand place as the definition being a space to which meaning has been ascribed, right? That place is a place where humans and land, and maybe not humans, non-human things too, animals have ascribed meaning. And then that meaning has re-imprinted the people, right? So it's a cycle. So I'd been studying all of this in sort of a philosophical kind of way and in a craft way. And then I'm reading Tim's The Missing, and there's this scene where the guy is walking through New Orleans. I think it might be in the French Quarter, but I'm not 100% sure. It's been years. And he's smelling each place as opposed to just seeing it. Mm-hmm. And this thing clicked in my head. It was like, oh, place is home, right? Setting is not time and place. Setting is like someone's home or someone's home that they're running from, or, right? That's so different. And so that was a huge moment for me in understanding that place is the thing that makes you who you are, even if you're running from it, even if it's a bad imprint. Right. And whatever we humans experience, we feed into that place. We scar that land and it scars us back. And that changed everything for me. Just that understanding. And thank you, Tim, for The Missing, which is a fabulous book. Everyone should read it. And then that was all just really solidified in reading Tom Franklin's Poachers. If you haven't read that collection of short stories and you're interested in place, especially along the Gulf Coast, it's a masterclass in writing place.
Interesting.
Wow. What strikes me, because I like a lot of psychological fiction too, is the idea of place being in the head and a movable feast of memory, sort of. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're talking about setting, you're obviously talking about where the character is.
Physicality.
Yeah. And what's going on with that too. But I love that you've brought in a more philosophical element of it. So there's so many aspects of these stories when I was reading Moon Trees and Other Orphans that were really poignant and different. And I loved that. I loved the sense of place in them and the way they approach people who aren't always represented in fiction. You know, like the characters in the story about the caffeinated breast milk racket. I mean, where does that come from, right? I'm like, I've never even heard of this thing. This thing is so wild. These characters are very wild, but I love that. Or the young girl wielding a shotgun, or the man who receives a package of breast implants in the mail. In these stories, there's things like bleached gator skulls and characters on acid. Can you speak to how do you make choices in terms of which moments to capture, which stories, whose stories?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that happens for me as a writer is curiosity is my number one tool. If I'm listening to the news and something catches my attention, it usually does so because I have questions about it. I read a lot of science journals. I read a lot of science news, a lot of nature news. So a lot of that gets folded in. So a good example of this is I was listening to NPR years ago, and there was a little news article about Stuart Roosa, the smoke jumper who became an astronaut and took a forest full of tree seeds to the moon. And I was like, oh my God, that's a crazy story. That sounds like a fairy tale, like a fable.
Yeah.
And I couldn't shake it. And I thought, well, if this means so much to me, if this imprints so heavily on me, if this idea of these trees that were planted from seeds that went to the moon and then were like given as gifts everywhere, if I can't stop thinking about that, what would that do in someone's mind who struggled with the delineation of fact or reality from other things? And this just basically, what could this mean to someone? Just kept rolling around in my head. And that's how the titular story sort of was born. So I think that questions are often the place. You mentioned the breast milk one.
That's... Yeah, I love that one. Can I just tell you, I read that story and I kept going, oh no, she didn't. Oh yeah, she did. What is happening here?
And there's so many elements to it, like my anxiety and my fears about the world. What if I got worse? What would that look like is part of the questionnaire. Another one was I was driving 2 hours to work every day to teach and 2 hours home. And I was eating a lot of caffeine candy to stay awake. So I sort of learned a whole lot about the world of caffeine during that time. Really crazy and interesting world. And then I came across a news article again about bodybuilders drinking breast milk and all of this crazy lore, right? This crazy folklore in the bodybuilding world about an athletic world about breast milk. And I was like, these things started just clashing together and the story was born. I'm not sure that I'm making a lot of really big decisions when I'm writing. I'm really asking questions as opposed to making decisions. Like, what if? What would it be like? What does this look like? What does this feel like? How do we lose someone and keep going? Why do we become bad when we're good people? How do bad people suddenly do something wonderful and beautiful? How does that even happen? That's where my stories come from. I wish I was a big decision maker, but instead I'm just a big questioner.
Well, you know what I love is that you're not afraid to bring things into stories that you don't see in stories. Like, I think what was so shocking and vivid for me about it was the idea that here's breast milk. When have I ever read about breast milk in a story? Here it is. I'm loving it. Oh my gosh. Like, I'm so disturbed because it's like a huge creepy baby of caffeine and breast milk imagery or something going on. And I felt like it kind of was oddly very satisfying to see something scary going on with breast milk. But at any rate, there's also a lot of aspects to these stories that, I mean, the stories have this really nice movement between shock and being very moving and really narrowing the lens and bringing the focus into a very close filter. I loved the sense of place in them and the way they approach people. And I also love when there are quieter places in them too. Like, I have to tell you, the story called Pulpo, I love that. I've read it like 3 times. It's tiny. It's a very short story. It explores the narrator watching her father cook. I think it's an octopus, right? And contrasts her life at work, which happens to be, I think, in a lab where there's research going on about octopi, thing of that nature, with this very evocative home and identity as the daughter of an immigrant. So this particular story was such a sleeper. It was such a quiet little story, but it just kind of infiltrated my mind and I kept thinking about it. And I loved how the word pulpo kept moving through it. I'm saying that wrong. It probably is like pulpo or something with a little better accent than I gave it. So it reminded me a little bit of how Junot Diaz often integrated Spanish words into his short stories. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking, how vivid is it when multiple languages interject themselves into stories? How does it create that kind of world of the story? So what informs your choice to use more than one language? And what does it evoke for you when you're doing that in your work?
I never wrote about Hispanic people at first. My dad was born in Cuba. He immigrated with his family when he was young. And, you know, my mother is American. And I only wrote white Americans at the very beginning. But that was not a very true piece of my reality. I've never lived in a world with only white Americans.
Right.
I'm a Southerner. And I realize that a lot of Southern literature would make you believe that that's all that exists in the South. But boy, howdy, it ain't.
So you think like maybe the representation was so lacking in literature that when you were initially modeling your prose, you weren't adding things that were relevant to you because you hadn't seen it?
Yeah, I think it's partially because I hadn't seen it. Partially because, you know, I moved back to Louisiana in my senior year of high school after Andrew, and I didn't know any other Hispanic people in Louisiana for years, despite the fact that there were a lot of Cuban immigrants in some parts of Louisiana for a long time. But the parts I lived in, they'd all left or I just didn't know them. And my world became smaller because of it. But I did know immigrants of all sorts. I knew all kinds of immigrants. And I realized that none of us were in stories that I was reading in classes for the most part. Even African Americans, even Black Americans were there, but not there.
Right.
And one of the things that I think I've learned over time is that I don't care. If like you're reading it and you're like, why are all of these people not just like me? I feel like maybe you're not my audience.
Right. Yeah, those people are not your audience. We are your audience. I'm telling you right now. No, I love that. I love seeing different people. It kind of reminded me, weirdly, if I might say this, of when I was reading Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son, mm-hmm. because all of a sudden we're seeing heroin addicts, right?
Right.
And this is not something I had been reading in literature. So when you come across an author who's like, well, you know, forget it. I'm just going to throw in the people that I know.
Right.
That makes it's so exciting and it's like so vivid and it just makes the story so much more interesting to me.
I had an early reader say to me, what gives you the right to tell these stories about people who work on rigs or who are lower class or whatever? And I was like, because these are the people I know. They're the people I've grown up with. They're the people I love. Yeah. They're the people I am. You know, I think there's an assumption because I'm pale. I present very white. I now have a PhD. There's an assumption about because of my educational level and my career choices and the way that I present that I belong to a group that I've never felt comfortable in, which is sort of an upper
class. And that's all that you should be writing about.
That's all that I should be writing about. If I don't really know those people, I certainly can't write about them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I do know a lot of petty criminals, or I used to at one point in time in my life. So I certainly can write about them.
It rings true also. You can tell when someone does not have that experience and they're writing it and it's a reach. But mm-hmm. with yours, it's just very authentic and real. And it feels like you are these people and know these people.
To be clear, though, someone has once asked me if I've ever killed anyone because there's a lot of murder in my writing. And I would like to just tell the whole world right now, I have not, nor do I plan to.
Well, you know, I love that you brought up that issue of feeling like your first writing was coming out with an imprint of a kind of like this homogenized American identity that didn't have a lot of the more vivid aspects of culture or upbringing that may be true to you. Another thing I noticed, I'm going to check in with you right now, which I'm not sure if you've noticed, is I am living in Southern California, okay? And I crave stories about the West Coast. I'm so sick of reading about New Yorkers, I gotta be honest. So
don't even get me started.
Yeah, so it feels like literature is owned by New York and every person, no matter where they were born, writes this obligatory New York subway story or some shit like that, even if they've never even been there, right?
Yeah.
But you have these college students who are like, we were in New York, you know, Manhattan and da-da-da-da-da, or, you know, and I think that the real taste and flavor and desire for a larger part of the nation, culturally, aesthetically, geographically, everything is out there now. People want to see their people represented.
Yeah. And I think that we can see that a lot by not just writing, but by the way television has changed. There was a point where every television show on multiple major channels happened in in New York, right? We had Mad About You and Friends, and like they all were in blocks of each other. And, you know, you'd watch these shows and sure they were funny, but like, I don't know any people like that. I've never known any people like that. Like, I don't, it was, you know, it's hard to get into that. And that's, I think, changing on the screen. And so I don't want to.
Faster than in literature. Do you notice that like Netflix series, movies, everything, so much better representation in TV and film than in literature? I mean, I was asking 3 years ago, where is the representation in quote unquote literature? Is the elitism so high that it's taking so long for it to move into the writing field?
It has been taking a long time.
It's taken so long. And it's, you know, and there's so many aspects to it. It's a multifaceted problem. I was told, and I'm not going to name any names, not specifically to me, but to a whole class in by a writer, that no interesting stories happen in the suburbs unless it's satire.
Oh,
I mean, what does that even mean? And then that writer was not rural. Like, if I'm not in a city, that I'm not, I don't exist. I don't have a story to tell. That's a really disturbing thing to put out there.
It is very.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had a collection that was recently reviewed in the New York Times, and there was something that was, I really appreciated it being reviewed as a woman, as a magical realist, as an independent press author, as the 8 million things that are probably operating against my success. Having anything appear in the New York Times is a big deal, so I don't want to begrudge that at all. But there was something about how I was telling stories about ordinary lives.
Right.
And I kind of thought, you know, with extraordinary circumstances, writing about ordinary lives with extraordinary circumstances, in this case, it was magical realism. But, you know, why are the lives less important in the suburb of Southern California than they are in any other place that may be usually represented in lit?
You know, I think that's, it goes right along with the regional writer label, right? New York writing isn't regional, but everyone else is, right? New York writing.
Southern writing is regional, right?
Yeah. It's like New York writing matters.
No, right. They're not ordinary lives. Everyone else is just ordinary. You know, it's really, there's an elitism that's hard to escape. It's like the gravitational pull of this elitism is so great that it's very hard to pull yourself out of that. I've recently decided to no longer use italics when using Spanish language or other languages in my writing. And I'm also moving away from translating as well. I've decided that there's an exoticism that goes along with those two things that, and then neither of them are necessary in a world with Google, right? They used to be necessary. They really aren't anymore. And
unless you're like Lydia Davis translating Proust or something like
Right. No, I mean, translations of works is great, but like when people repeat everything that's in another language in their own short story in English.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm no longer willing to do that.
You're teaching people like to read. You're doing an experimental technique to kind of normalize the presence of foreign words in your work.
Exactly. I feel like, I'm not going to give myself any credit. I'm not the only person out there doing this. There are a lot of people smarter than me that started this movement. But I will say I'm really dedicated to this idea. Everybody in America who watched Sesame Street can speak some basic Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. I don't think everyone should have to be able to speak it or read it. My story should make sense even if you can't read the Spanish words. But that doesn't mean I have to do the work of translating them to you, right? I don't have to. And if you can't tell the words are in Spanish when you read the story, unless they're italicized, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're like, what is this jumble of letters? That's like a problem. So yeah, I'm trying to move away from this exotification of the other in my writing, even though I make fun of it a lot. Like if you read these stories, there's a lot of taking those tropes and trying to turn them on their end, but I don't want, that's different than kowtowing to it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about translation, this is really interesting to me because as an academic, it's even more important how you spend your time in terms of your tenure clock and being advanced and all of that sort of thing. Now, when you say translation, are you just referring to little fragments of language that you may interject into stories? Or are you also talking about, hey, guess what? I'm not going to do a lot of translation work at all in a larger context.
Well, I'm not qualified to do translation work in a larger context. So that I don't really have an opinion on. I think it's important that listeners know that I am not literate in Spanish, that I'm working on it. But like many children of immigrants, my native tongue is English as opposed to the native tongue of my family.
Yeah,
so,
my mom is Mexican and her mother never taught her Spanish. So she doesn't know Spanish. I don't know Spanish.
Well, you know, my grandmother wouldn't speak anything but Spanish to me, and she wouldn't let anyone else speak anything but Spanish to me. But I was a sort of angry child, and I took French in high school for reasons I can't explain, although I love that I can read some French. And I can read some Spanish because Spanish is surprisingly easy to read in terms of phonetically, right? And I'm getting better. I'm working on it. It's one of the great regrets of my life that I am not fully bilingual or fully trilingual, which I really should be. So I'm working on that. And I think that as I move through that process, that's going to be reflected in my art.
Well, I have a question about your influences. I read about a connection between your work and Flannery O'Connor's. Do you see her in your work? How do you feel about that? And what were some of your bigger influences?
So I would like to start by saying everyone who has ever compared me to Flannery O'Connor, thank you.
I love her so much.
Right. She was fantastic, if problematic in certain ways.
Right, right. Especially with the new controversy about people saying they've found all of this somewhat racist stuff.
Well, and you can see racism in a lot of her work. It's there. I'm not surprised by everything that's coming out. That being said, Flannery O'Connor was a magnificent writer, and her sensibilities are the sensibilities of the people that I come from in many ways, right?
Right.
So I think that there's no doubt that there is an influence there. But I'm going to be honest, that's not what I was reading when I was 12, right? In my teen years, I was reading Elmore Leonard. And So I think that influence has got to be in my writing, right? I've got a bunch of people shooting each other. And I was reading Douglas Adams. And that wit is so important to me. As an adult, I've spent a lot of time reading contemporary authors like Tom Franklin, who I wrote my master's thesis on, my MFA. So My influences are wide. I've also been influenced by film quite a bit. I come from the TV generation. And so everything, Kung Fu films that I loved in my 20s and Tarantino. I like action. I like energy.
I can see all of that in your writing. I can see it.
Yeah. And then,
isn't it interesting how people just like when they say, who are your influences? So many times writers will just give other writers when really we're living in so much more of a, you know, multimedia world right now.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the problems. I can't tell you everyone who influenced me. A huge influence on me were my mother and father. Both of them are storytellers. They aren't writers, but my dad weaved these crazy stories about people flying air balloons to the moon for me as a child. And my mother would tell me about the time that her horses ate her stepfather's back seat in a car, right? Like weaving tales is my heritage.
Right. Yeah.
So my influences are a lot.
Wow, wonderful. As a writer, how have things changed for you now with the state of the world as it is, either on the front end or with your creative processes or the back end of publishing this book? Have you felt like anything has changed in your immediate reality with the way that you're creating or?
Everything has changed. I'm a very energetic person, but I'm also a person with a lot of anxiety. I have some health problems that make this current situation a little more frightening for me. I have asthma and I have an autoimmune disease. So that all has highlighted my fears. I haven't left the house very much, and I'm going to be honest, I haven't written very much. So that has been a thing. Additionally, my big events were canceled. I feel like the second COVID came, my book stopped existing in the world, which is fine. This is certainly more important than a little collection of short stories, but it's strange. It's just all very strange. On the other hand, I've had chances to do a lot of stuff like this, which honestly, I'm enjoying a lot. I didn't have the money to travel the world on a big book tour or even a few states, right? And so some of it's great.
Yeah. You know, my friend Sequoia the other day was talking about how, as we all know, the literary industry is not a meritocracy. You can have the most gorgeous book that ever came out, but not get all the press for it or the marketing. And it can be really hard. And then people who live in different areas may have a more difficult time having readings. And Sequoia was talking about, which I thought was kind of wonderful, how during the time of COVID, although it's difficult to promote books in some respects, in other respects, you're seeing this kind of egalitarian normalizing and equalizing of people from different presses as the audiences can hear people read who would never have been able to go to the bookstore or the bookstores where someone was reading. So that's
there's such interesting collaborations that are happening now. Authors interviewing other authors, things on all different kinds of platforms for accessibility purposes. A lot of things have come from it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think one of of the problems is we still don't really know how to capitalize on that. And I think that what's going to happen is we're going to learn from this time. And even when it is no longer absolutely necessary to do this, we're going to do this and we're going to do it better. We're going to continue reaching areas that haven't been reached before. Those of us who do not live in big book centers are going to have a bigger voice. And I think that we will learn from this and grow it out.
And I love, can I just tell you, I love the element of there being an artifact. Like the fact that things aren't happening in a private place, like a bookstore where everybody's sitting in the same room and stuff like that. The fact that it's happening on Zoom and getting recorded, it's almost making this enormous, beautiful, elaborate library of reading.
Oh, absolutely. And it's going to be amazing for professors and teachers bringing these kinds of tools into the classrooms to create truly multi-voice classrooms is going to be a really big part of what comes out of this.
Yeah. Lee, I wanted to ask, what do you think is the most important thing for women writing literary fiction to do to gain legitimacy or visibility for their work?
I think the first thing that you have to do is understand that people are going to want to talk about you being a woman a lot and that that's okay. I think there's a knee-jerk reaction for some of us who are like, again with the woman stuff. But it actually is important because the more we talk about it, the more doors we open for other women. Mm-hmm. I've bristled sometimes. For example, I've been told that I don't know if I've talked about this before. I'm often told that I write like a man and that...
No, you have not talked about that.
And that is, it's like a really sore spot for me because I'm not sure. People say it as a compliment and that really bugs me.
Yeah, it's the fact that they think that's a compliment that's kind of obnoxious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't read you completely as a strong female voice. I don't read you like a man at all.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I also think that it's, you know, I think one of the things is don't be afraid to be a woman in writing.
Yeah.
Newsflash, women sell more books across the spectrum than men do. We are less represented in literary writing. And I think that there's one way to stop that, and that's not to stop.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have any other advice for new writers? I mean, I'm sure you share this with your classes because you also have an academic appointment. But what do you think are like the top, let's just give us the top three things that you would tell new writers if you want them to succeed and continue to make connections in the industry?
Read writers who are writing today. It's my number one thing. Read them. Don't be afraid of them. And that's advice I have to keep giving myself because you may meet them and that's awesome. That shouldn't be terrifying. It will be, but it shouldn't be. So read people who are writing today. That's my number one advice I give everybody. Two, it's okay if you are not the perfect online writer, right? There are all of these rules that you will see online. Write every day. I can't write every day. Mm-hmm. I just can't. My life does not allow for it. Neither does my brain. I write 1,000 words and don't look back. I can't do that, right? You don't have to fit some sort of strange mold that the internet has decided a writer is. What you have to do is write, continue to write, rewrite, and get better at writing, which requires reading, dissecting, right? That's, I guess, my biggest advice is find what works for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Well, I can't wait to hear you read today from Moon Trees and Other Orphans because I've been waiting for this and I'm excited. But before we do that, Ran, can you tell us about today's cocktail so that those who are listening can kind of get their cocktail ready if that's what they'd like to do before we hear the reading?
Sure. Today's cocktail is called Prettier in Pink, and the recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make it and have it while you listen to Lee read. It has gin, orange liqueur, cherry juice, elderflower tonic, and I've made one. I'm going to make it for myself. I know y'all started first, but I'm having mine now. So give me a second. Lee, this was actually a cocktail you created, right? Is it your favorite at the moment?
It is. Yes. And it is my favorite. I've usually got the ingredients on hand almost always. This afternoon, I had to have Prosecco instead. But yes, this is my little cocktail.
It's really delicious. So tell us about the excerpt you're going to share with us today.
So I thought today that I would read from the short story Shallowing. And I'm just going to, I always try to read from the beginning of stories because I love beginnings. I think that they open up the world to us. The other side is it means I don't have to explain a whole lot. Shout out to TriQuarterly, who originally published this piece, and of course to Black Lawrence for publishing it in the book. Shallowing. Cairo swung the muzzle of her shotgun up and trained the barrel on a dove. From the doorway of the sagging porch, she could see several pears and trees on both sides of the bayou, but she kept her focus tight. She didn't pull the trigger. She just sighted down the barrel, leading her target as it lifted into the air. After a while, she lowered her gun. a Remington 870 her father had given her nearly a year ago for her 19th birthday. Then she picked out another dove, swung it up again, and keeping her back, neck, and head straight, she leveled the gun to her eye, not her eye to the gun. She watched the birds this way until her anxiety eased. The doves were out of season, and Cairo didn't hunt anyway. She liked sighting them, though. It made her feel good, doing something that came natural, easy, something she could do in her sleep. No struggle, no thinking. In the morning, she'd once again try to tell her father that she was leaving college. She pulled the gun back up, trained it on a fat red squirrel with a high tail. Boom, she said. Boom, boom, as it crossed from branch to branch, pretending to shoot it over and over as it knocked paper shell pecans to the ground. When she dragged herself out of bed the next day, hungover from drinking on the porch after her father had gone to bed, but ready to finally come clean, he'd already left for work. A bouquet of swamp lilies he'd set out in a tin coffee can, the closest thing to a note that she'd get. Charlie showed up at her window with a six-pack around noon and badgered her to come out in the air with him. You're only home for the summer, he said, and she didn't tell him that she was home for good, that she didn't like Tulane, that New Orleans always smelled bad, that she was failing everything. And she thought it was a date, finally a date, Charlie showing up like that. She told him to hold on and slipped into her suit and cutoffs as fast as she could, but they didn't make it two houses down the bank before meeting up with a few others, and the six-pack became one of four, and then one of six, and when they got to the creek in the bayou where the bank swelled high enough to jump from, the dirt became crowded with discarded jeans and tank tops and faded blue work shirts. A good fourth of her old high school class was there, basically just where she'd left them at Christmas, at Thanksgiving, last summer, the summer before that. Someone stole a nylon rope off a nearby skiff, and Cairo tied a monkey's fist in the tail end before climbing the old twin oak, scraping her knee like a 12-year-old and trying not to yelp. She fixed the other end to the farthest branch and shimmied down the trunk. The nooks and juts and forks she put her hands and feet on, as familiar as her own childhood bed. She was the last to jump. Sunlight flashed off the water below so brightly that she had to squint whether she looked up or down. She took a running leap off the height of the bank, and then Cairo was in the air, legs wheeling over the water, fingers clenched above the monkey's fist. The moment before letting go always filled her with tight panic, but now it was just more of the same stomach-sick fear she'd worn for months. If she chickened out and held on too long, her hands burning from the effort, she'd hit the muddy water where it was shallowing. She knew the jutting bed below held shifting rocks and roots and branches that crack her bones and scar her skin. She'd seen a boy break his leg here when she was 13 and help pull him from the water. And now, as she swung, the memory of his head lolling on the surface, eyes open way too wide, came to her. The sweet spot was right after the lowest point in the rope's speeding arc, and Cairo let go just as she wanted to grip the tightest. A catcall from the shore followed her down, and she hoped it was Charlie, whose hands found her stomach under her shirt the couple of times they'd kissed, board or trunk, or she didn't know what, times she didn't know how or why they started, or how or why they stopped. Everyone else seemed to like the fall from the rope, sounding like drunks at a parade, hooting and hollering all the way to the splash, but she hated those seconds. Cairo's favorite part, the only part worth anything at all, was there, right after she hit the water, exploding past the surface. It was in the silence after that initial shock, where gravity itself seemed to struggle, its pull fighting friction, her arms floating up as her torso plunged down. That was where she wanted to live. Something brushed past her leg, and Cairo choked, silty brine. She tried to scream, sucked in water instead. She scissor-kicked to the surface and sputtered there, her friends laughing from the bank. She didn't like this part of the bayou. Deep enough to hold their plunging bodies, it hid life, the water still and cloudy underneath you. Last night, her father told her that he'd killed an alligator that had been hanging around their end of the bank. Barely a week ago, he said. It's been busy here, he said. He'd looked at her over his coffee, his hip leaned against the kitchen cabinet, and had confessed to rolling the animal under a log after the last bend in their stretch of the bayou, hiding it there to rot. The kill was out of season. But what do? The damn thing was a foot off our pier every single morning, and the Wheeler baby has just started walking. You should see.
see her, he said. While he was hiding the carcass, she'd been asleep in her dorm, skipping a final. She slipped into a breaststroke and pulled as fast as she could, trying to beat whatever had slithered past. She was a good swimmer, a strong swimmer, and it only took a few strokes for her to feel safe, her toes bouncing at the riverbed as she struggled to stand and climb the bank. Charlie put his arm in and caught her like he might grab a catfish, his hand sliding down her shoulder, past her bicep, towards her elbow as he searched for his grip, and Caro could smell him, a smell faintly like turned over earth. See, he said, as if they'd made a bet and he'd won, as if she'd fought coming out to swing and swim with him. See? See what? I'm the one who climbed up and put out the rope, Caro said, but you didn't want to. And Charlie was right. Caro did it because he'd asked. She sat down on the towel she'd brought and leaned back into the heat, hoped Charlie would sit with her. Instead, he took another run at the rope. She didn't bother to watch. Knew he'd fly with grace, fall with grace, even sputter to the surface with grace. He was that sort. Caro hovered her eyes with her hand and leaned all the way back so that her face pointed directly into the sun and her fingers glowed orange and she imagined the water lifting from her skin in a steam. Hey, City, you want another beer? Caro nodded. She didn't have to look to see who was talking or to know they were talking to her. She'd sat in class with each and every person there from first grade to 12th, 10th or 11th for those who dropped out. She lived in a two-school bend in the road that no one moved to and barely anyone figured out how to move from. And she was the only one they called City. The other three or four who'd gone off to school, they stayed gone. Caro just lacked the sense. Charlie didn't sit next to her until she'd had two more beers and was ready to leave. But when he did, he dripped cool water across her legs and she forgot how hot and bored and tired of the noise she was. He put a hand around her ankle. You coming out later? At Tulane, out meant a bar filled with smoke on a street that smelled like piss. Here it meant a field or a clearing, usually not far from the smell of manure or swamp gas, or it had when they were in school together.
You going to tip cows?
That's some ignorant shit. She made a show of rolling her eyes at her own failed joke, one that people at Tulane used on her when she told them where she was from, trying to be too cool for any of it. But she wanted to go where Charlie went.
Yeah, probably.
She'd meant to have dinner with her daddy tonight, maybe finally come clean, but Charlie's hand was on her.
Yeah,
she said again, putting her hands back over her eyes and collapsing to the towel like she could hardly feel his fingers tight against her ankle, biting at her there.
Thank you so much for reading that.
Yeah, that was...
I love that story.
Great. I was so in it.
I know that's part of the problem. I'm like sitting here listening. I'm like, oh, wait, I need to talk too. Lee, I wanted to ask you about the cover of the book too. I really love the artwork on it. If anyone can't see it yet, it's yellow with a pink photo of a little girl smoking a cigarette looking very sassy. Can you tell us about that?
When I saw this picture, I fell in love with this little girl and I was terrified that the book would be banned from bookstores if we used it. But I loved her so much. And there are no smoking children in the book, but it is definitely in a world where smoking children exist.
Yeah.
And she just, heart and soul, felt like one of the characters. The other thing is, and I've told my mother this, so I don't think she'll mind if I say this, she reminds me of my mother, who did not smoke as a child, just to be clear. But there's just something about her that did. People often ask me if it's a picture of me. It is not. Just to put that out there.
I like all your caveats today, Lee. No, I didn't shoot or kill anybody.
I didn't smoke
when she was a child.
people make a lot of very strange assumptions about me
They
only read my writing. I'll tell a little short story. I once was doing a reading at my PhD. We were supposed to do readings, right? Like a couple of times a year. And so everybody there had heard me read before. And I started by saying, oh, guess what, guys? Nobody dies in this one. And I was reading two parts that from the same work, but that were separated. And so I finished the first part and I was like, and between this and the next part, so-and-so dies. And the whole room was like, you lied. Because I am known for killing people in my work. Not everybody dies in this book though. So it's probably safe to buy.
Wow. Well, I kill a lot of people too. I feel it. I know it's necessary. So tell us, just kind of echoing back to your refrain of earlier talking about reading contemporary contemporary authors. What's on your reading table right now? Or is there a book you've read recently that you just couldn't put down?
Right now I'm reading, and I'm terrified I'm going to say this wrong. I'm reading China Melville's Perdido Station. And I'm also reading Chris Abani's Secret History of Las Vegas, which are two really interesting and strange and wonderful books. And I just recently read a book that's about to come out and a book that just came out by people I know. And I just caveat, I'm not just giving plugs. These are amazing books. One is Half by Sharon Harrigan, and it's the story of two twins. It has a little magical realism in it, and it is in first person plural, so it's a wee voice, and it is magnificent. And I just finished reading John McNally's The Fear of Everything, which is coming out soon, which, despite being a collection of literary short stories, is very genre bending. So there's some magical realism, some sci-fi, some sort of gritty noirish stuff, and then it's all very heartfelt. So that's been my reading list for the past couple of weeks. I'm a slow reader, but I read a couple of books at a time.
Yeah, I read more than one book at a time too. So what is your next project and what are you hoping to do in the next 12 months?
Oh God, I don't know.
This is the hard question during the COVID, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to finish a novel, and it is a novel set in predominantly in South Louisiana in a town that is fictional, but is based on the town around Bayou Corn that was swallowed by a sinkhole. And so I'm writing a story that deals with a family that lives there that are sort of grifterish and people in the town as a sinkhole that they don't know is there because you don't starts to swallow their town. And it has some elements of grit lit and then some elements of magical realism as well. So
that's exciting.
Yeah. I'm hoping it will work. We'll see.
Yeah. It's all the big experiment as you're writing something, right? Until at least you get through the first draft.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm about 100 or so pages in.
Wow. Well, this is amazing. Listen, thank you so much for spending your time with us at Book Tales today. We really enjoyed hearing your work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. And everyone who's listening, please go out and grab Lee's book, Moon Trees and Other Orphans, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks for this podcast series. Please subscribe to this podcast too, which releases once a month for more conversations with amazing literary authors. See you next time.